Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot of people seem to think that a scorecard is going to solve all your problems. A scorecard is a tool that helps you make decisions. The strategy component arrives when you look at, okay, so how do we treat specific accounts? There were two things that I really wanted to achieve when I stepped out on my own. One was increasing retail consumer credit risk knowledge out there in the analytical world. And then the other piece is I work with senior analysts as they begin to step into their first leadership roles. A lot of us analyst types, the soft skills, they don't necessarily come naturally to us. And I include myself in that. Yet we all respond really well to those being done well. So it's something that we need to learn and be aware of.
It was 1954 and Alan Blake had a problem. He had recently founded the South Sea Sub Aqua Club, but its members were complaining that the British winter was too cold for diving. Fair enough. I learned to scuba dive in India, did my advanced training in the Philippines, and only once left the tropics, and that was to the Med in summer. I'm no fan of cold water myself. That said, I'm not sure Alan's solution was all that much better. The sea was too cold, and so, with all the empathy of my old phys ed teacher, he got them into the swimming pool instead. I don't know. Maybe they had an indoor heated pool, but I doubt it. Anyway, Alan Blake had just invented Octopush, or what we now call underwater hockey. Welcome to How to Lend Money to Strangers with Brendan LaGrange. Carolyn Rom, author, consultant, and trainer on all things consumer credit modeling. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Lovely to be here.
It's lovely to have you. Carolyn, you're passionate about bringing the gold standard of consumer credit risk assessment to everyone. But when I saw that we were both UCT alumni, I took a closer look at your LinkedIn profile and realized that, shock and horror, credit risk might not have been your first love. So before we talk to the work that you're doing at the moment, talk to me about oceanography, psychology, and how you went from that to retail credit risk.
So I went to university like so many people do. A lot of people, they know exactly what they're going to do, and I envy those people. I'm not one of them. I had no clue what I wanted to do. So I did, my undergrad is this entire mishmash of subjects that I loved. I've got some physics in there, some astrophysics in there, some English, some stats, some geology. And I ended up doing a major, double major in psychology and oceanography. Oceanography is all about ocean and atmosphere and physics. And I loved it. It was amazing. It was really interesting. And I did psychology because I also found that quite interesting, mostly because I've been told I'm really difficult my whole life. And I don't think I'm that difficult. So I wanted to understand more about that. So yeah, that's kind of my undergrad. And then I did more oceanography. Then I realized that perhaps I didn't want to work in science. And I did a 2-year stint at BAT, where we manufactured cigarettes back in the bad old days. And then I landed a role as a credit risk analyst. No one has found a clear link between those things, but mostly it was stuff that was interesting. So that's what I did.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you did because, you know, one of the things I regret now is that I studied commerce for my undergrad degree and then commerce for my master's. It worked in a bank and it's all very straight down the line, but it's not one of those fields where you need to specialize like a doctor or an engineer. So you may as well study and become, you know, more educated and more interesting. But Carolyn, your sort of leaps from one thing to another didn't end there. You then moved from the southernmost tip of Africa and somehow managed to get even further south, continuing your career in New Zealand. My gut feel is that it's quite a dramatically different risk landscape than South Africa. So if we continue that sort of story of your early career, What did you learn and experience differently when you got into New Zealand and you saw the lending landscape there compared to what you'd started to get to know in South Africa?
That's an awesome question. So in South Africa, I primarily worked with the retailers, and they did a combination of credit cards and in-store cards and personal loans to their customers. And in South Africa, we had a lot of data available to us. So within the credit bureau, we could see positive and negative information. And if we really wanted to, we could ask the bureau to send us a whole bunch of batch characteristics, which really goes down to the number of active trade lines you have, or the number of open trade lines you have, or the percentage payments, which means that we could actually do some fairly advanced credit risk analytics. When I arrived in New Zealand and I got my first role in a bank, I was stunned, and I honestly mean stunned, to discover that from a credit bureau point of view, they only had negative information. And what that means is they could see whether someone had made an inquiry for credit, and they could see whether someone had gone so delinquent that they had a judgment or a default against them. But that was kind of it. I mean, you could see how much the default was worth, but what you couldn't see was whether people were actually making their payments on the credit lines that they had. In fact, you couldn't even see how many credit lines someone had. Never mind what their total exposure was in terms of balance and things like that. And I remember, I think this is back in 2009, sort of just post-GFC, just sitting there going, how does anyone do their job? Because all the information I was so used to seeing just wasn't available from a bureau point of view. That was probably the most dramatic change that I saw in terms of what was available from a data point of view. From a risk point of view, I remember I was in a bank and I had come out of retail in South Africa, and I was working with the collection managers and teams, and they were hugely concerned about what they considered to be their very high levels of arrears. And they were working incredibly hard and they were doing everything that they could. And the more senior levels of the bank were looking at the levels of arrears and being really concerned and giving them a bit of a hard word, and being myself and saying what I thought without necessarily thinking it through, I just said, I know people in South Africa who would give their firstborn for arrears rates that look this good. And everyone thought I had lost the plot. So yes, they're very different environments.
The same sort of time I was in Scandinavia and Northern Europe, and they were transitioning there from negative to comprehensive credit bureaus. And you know, what people often didn't realize is it was the low risk, the good customers who benefit by comprehensive, because if you can only see negative data, you're either bad or you're just everybody else. There's no way to find that nuance. You know, have you paid all of your one loans, or have you paid all of your 300 loans over 20 years in different ways? You know, it can give us far more certainty in our modeling. And as soon as you go comprehensive, it really just frees it up for consumers who've been paying well to get the services and rewards from that. But before we talk too long on credit bureaus and risk differentials between South Africa and, I'd argue, many markets around the world where they wouldn't quite stomach the delinquency rates that are normal there. About 2 years ago, I stepped out of the corporate world and I cited the stress of working through COVID lockdowns as one of the factors involved. But you guys in New Zealand didn't really seem to have too much of an issue with COVID. So maybe it's just coincidental, but roughly the same time there in 2021, you also struck out on your own, not just as a credit risk trainer in the traditional sense, but as a coach and a mentor too. What does that entail? What are you helping other credit analysts to do?
Just a little piece on COVID. We went into lockdown, and in Auckland, we went into horrendous lockdown. But from a COVID impacting life here, yes, we had it much better. But anyway, yes, you're right. I did. I left proper corporate world, and then I worked with a much smaller organization, which was awesome. And then I decided to go it alone. And one of my key reasons for doing that and going into training and mentoring is, the way I see it, there are two key gaps in the market, gaps in credit risk analytics. The first one is the fact that we learn credit risk analytics from our line managers. So if you have a line manager who has worked in a large organization where they've seen all the different aspects, from origination through to collections, a little bit of marketing, some recoveries, account management, limit increases, etc., you're likely to learn a lot. If, however, you've been quite limited in where you've been exposed, you don't get to learn so much. And there are some organizations where people are inventing the wheel as they go. So they don't necessarily have a credit risk specialist at the organization. For example, something as simple as decline overwrites. There are a lot of people who don't do their calculation right. And this holds true across the front end, so originations, certainly around collections, so transition matrices, what they are, why they're important, how to build them, how to interpret them. And you can get hold of consultants, and they, for a pretty penny, will come along and share their knowledge. But for the most part, that's how we learn. And then the other piece of the training that I do is I work with senior analysts as they begin to step into their first leadership roles. Because the other thing that is hugely, or I found, very relevant to my world, was that when you start leading, it's as if someone goes, here are the keys to the car. If you go, what do you mean you want driving lessons? Just go drive. And a lot of us analyst types are super introverted and really fact-oriented, and we like our processes, and we don't necessarily do the soft skills particularly well. Yet we all respond really well to those being done well, yeah. But they don't necessarily come naturally to us. And I include myself in that. But it's something that we need to learn and be aware of. How do we communicate with people up the chain? How do we take analytics? And when someone says, but I don't understand, as an analyst, our tendency is to double down on the detail.
Yeah.
And when you know what you're looking for, you can literally see people lose the will to live because they don't understand and that isn't helping and they're not number oriented. So just make it stop.
And of course, it's worth saying that because we live in a beautifully connected world these days, even though New Zealand is sometimes forgotten off of world maps, this is available to people around the world. The mentoring, the coaching, even the training can be delivered online too. And it's such an important aspect for any lender. Why the knowledgeable technical people they've got in their credit department are like gold. But you always have this difficult transition of you've got, you know, somebody starts out day one, they start to learn the tools, they've got an education maybe in statistics, and they become better and better and more knowledgeable about the tools, about how you build the models, becoming more technically proficient.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
And then somebody leaves or whatever happens, they say, we now need a team manager. Let's take our best analyst, you know, our most senior analyst, and promote them. Now, it's great to promote from within, but you can't just take somebody who's going up a technical path and say, manage the team. They may hate their new job. They may feel like they're missing the old technical things they were good at, and now they're out of their depth. And you can really cause huge problems in a very important part of the business if you don't do that, even though everybody's highly skilled and talented and wanting the best. So, yeah, I think that everybody listening should now go over to carolynrom.com and have a look. We'll come back to that in a minute. I won't disrupt us too much. But vitally important, I think, for any credit team to be thinking through the work you're doing. Even more important now than ever because, well, this I think probably people say all the time, but it feels like we're in a very changeable moment. So there's a lot of things we could discuss, and maybe we'll have you on another day and discuss some of them. But just to start, let's focus on what I think for many people at the moment is the most urgent one, collections. So firstly, what changes are you seeing in the way that lenders are thinking about their collections strategies, their collections data processes? And how do we think of modeling in this area? How do we think about our approaches perhaps differently?
Collections gets a lot of love when the economy goes slightly sideways. It does not get nearly so much love when everything is hunky-dory and growing at a rate of knots. Oh, it's such a big field. So before we even start talking about modeling, I'm going to talk about actual collection strategy design a little bit. A lot of people seem to think that a scorecard is going to solve all your problems. A scorecard, to be absolutely clear, is not a strategy. A scorecard is a tool that helps you make decisions. The strategy component arrives when you look at, okay, so how do we treat specific accounts? For example, people who are already in hardship. You want to pull out all of your accounts. I don't know how to contact this person. Put them in a separate queue so that you can work them. As someone who is under some sort of hardship or under some sort of administration, they don't go into your collections queues. Those are the sorts of things that start going into strategies. And then when we start talking about strategy, we've also got to look at how are we segmenting our population? Are we just grouping it based on how delinquent they are? You're a one cycle delinquent, therefore you go into this pile, and you're two cycles delinquent, you go into that pile. We're going to send you off to external collection agencies, etc., so that we can treat like risk people similarly. So if someone is actually generally a really good risk, they mostly pay on time and they've just dropped into arrears, you probably want to be a little bit more customer service oriented rather than bringing out the big guns. Conversely, if someone is recidivist and they've been on your books for a long time, what do you need to do to try and bring them out of that and bring them back into, you know, being a good customer and paying on time? This is particularly important when we talk about loans, because loan installments tend to be quite chunky. And once you've missed that first payment, it becomes increasingly difficult to bring yourself back up to date. So what we're seeing, certainly in this part of the world from a collections point of view, is that arrears are now back at pre-COVID levels. And in some instances, they're actually higher. And there are a lot of factors playing into this. Interest rates are higher. Cost of living is higher. Food, I was reading this morning, is something like up 18% or 20% or something terrifying, which if you're at the higher end of the economic scale, you can absorb some of those costs. But for people who are at the lower end, there is no more room to absorb these kind of costs. And of course, because everyone's a little bit concerned about the cost of living, there tends to be this, well, we're going to shut down the front end. And there's value in that, but that has an impact on what happens at the back end. So what we're seeing is a lot of people with increased arrears trying to work out how to minimize those arrears without losing customers and without having to write everything off. So yeah, there's a lot of focus on how do we do things differently. And of course, the legislation is getting more and more to the point where in the bad old days, you could quite yell and swear, but you know, they would harass you basically. Whereas now there's a much better sense of actually these are still customers and we still need to treat them like human beings.
You spoke about strategy there, and I think if there's a silver lining coming out of the COVID world, it's hopefully that a lot of eyes that never used to look at collections turn their eyes towards those sort of strategies as all customers, somewhat randomly, depending on what industries they were in, suddenly needing to take payment holidays or make some plans. And they couldn't do it by going into the branch, and your staff often couldn't be in the branch to take their phone calls. So there was a big push with pressure from many different directions to automate and make more customer friendly the early stages of collections. And you know, I've spoken to some people, I think I've been given better terms than collections for this stage of life, but I've forgotten them now. But this early stage collections, where it is customer management, where it is saying, okay, you've got some struggles, let's work with you. And that requires a lot more nuance when it comes to things like modeling, because in the old days, you could get away with just let's see how late they are and apply some very broad strategies. Now you really do want to understand early on what sort of collections is this person in. Is this person just a lazy payer? So this person may be having a short-term issue with their job. Is it a slower creep of affordability that they need to make some adjustments? Or is it somebody who just doesn't want to pay me and needs the old-fashioned yelling from a scary-sounding person? So we grow up building models that say, you know, the target definition's delinquency. We look for a few bad customers. We look for histories of delinquency and we build a nice scorecard. But when we flip it around now and we say, okay, now somebody's rolling into collections, what do we do differently there as a modeler? I'm sure this is happening in banks and lenders around the world at the moment. People being pulled off from the team that used to build application scores and saying, we need one of these for collections. What do they maybe think about differently in that capacity?
The principles remain the same. So you still need to work out what does good behavior look like versus bad behavior. And when I say bad behavior, I'm always so cognizant of, in the banking world, we can be so super judgy with our language. You are bad because you didn't make a payment. Well, actually, no, that's not strictly true, but it certainly can come across like that. But at the end of the day, we have to say zeros and ones. You're either in the group that we want more of or in your group we want less of. In the case of applications, what you're doing is you're saying, we're going to give these people credit and we're not going to give these other people credit. In the world of arrears management, you can't just say, well, we're going to take all the credit away, because that doesn't suddenly give you the money back. You can take away their ability to spend, but they still have a balance outstanding. So you can't just disregard them, not if you want a decent bottom line. So from a modeling point of view, we need to look at, how do we define the kind of behavior that we want? If someone makes their payment, is that good behavior? Or if someone misses their payment, is that poor behavior? And if they miss that payment, are you looking at how many payments over a specific number of months? Or are you looking at right now, right here, I'm only looking at the very short term. Are you making this payment? And you can get quite nuanced depending on what kind of data you have available. So we talk about, as a collector, you phone someone up, you've spoken to them, they said, oh, yes, actually, I will make a $50 payment every week for the next 6 weeks, and that will catch me up, and everyone's happy. In the event that they fail to keep that promise, is that what you're modeling? Or are you modeling something else? So the key pieces of modeling, I don't think particularly change. Your variables, the features that you're using, they certainly can change. You need to be clear on what you're defining as your observation point, as in application scoring. Really, really important that you don't take into account any events that occurred after that point. Typically, you would use the last 6 to 12 months worth of information on that customer to work out their likelihood of making payments. And then once you've got your model, the key thing is, how do you implement it? How do you work with the collections operations team? Because it's all good and well having this beautiful strategy, but if ops doesn't have the faintest idea what you're trying to achieve, they're not going to do what you'd like them to do. Especially in collections, it's about so much more than just the model. It's also about taking the operations team on a journey, which has less to do with modeling and much more to do with change management.
Yeah, but it's change management driven by the sort of person that you're talking about mentoring up front, because you need somebody to understand the impact. And if this is an early implementation of these sort of models, you really can be talking about big, significant amounts of impact you can make. Even in the old-fashioned bank-first mentality, you can save a lot of money in terms of write-offs, in terms of operational costs with these. And of course, now, you know, over the last decades, we've come a little bit more to appreciate the human side too, and we can see the huge impact. And I think it's the time to look at, how do we help consumers not end up in collections too late? And it's something I've only come to understand after I was working in collections, unfortunately. But one of the downsides, and this is not backed up by science, just my belief, but from the old mentality of collections as a scary process that you really didn't want to get into, scary because someone's going to shout at you, scary because legal looking letters are being sent to you, scary because, you know, it's just uncomfortable. People try to avoid it for as long as possible, which, you know, that was good for the bank, but it meant by the time we knew there was a problem, they had been trying to solve the problem themselves for a few months and by definition had failed. And what I think is really important now from a strategy side is, how do we get that consumer right up front, that they know collections isn't scary, that people can say early on, I'm feeling under pressure. I can see my bank account struggling. Maybe I'm working less, maybe something's happened, or maybe it's just the cost of living. I'm trying to adjust, see if I can get a 1 month payment holiday, or if I can extend my loan by a little bit and reduce my payments. From early on enough that we can save people, we can help them. And yeah, apply some of these new machine learning tools that are out there this new big data we've got access to, promise to pays and things, you know, were really hard not so long ago to capture and to model. But now those tools exist. So it's an exciting time, I think, for collections to move out of the sort of depth and the back room of the office in the operational center into a part of that data flow that's become so important to the banks.
And I mean, honestly, it's just the right thing to do.
Yeah.
I mean, they're your customers ultimately. And if you can help someone before it's all gone completely sideways, you've actually got yourself a customer for life.
Yeah,
and the cost of acquiring new customers is significantly more. We all know this. I mean, this is not a newsflash. New customer acquisition is an expensive hobby.
And then you've still got to find the customer that uses the product,
yeah.
You know, that builds a balance. Plus, the moment where we can create the biggest customer loyalty and the biggest brand experience uptick is when something's gone wrong and you try and get hold of somebody to fix it. If they fix it, that's actually, you end up liking that company more than before the problem happened.
Absolutely.
But of course, if they don't, it drops off the cliff. But it really is the perfect moment to find those customers who want to work with you, who will make a promise to pay, who will come in early these days on the app or something and ask for support to make those payments. Really self-identifying as an ideal customer. And if a lender is not investing in this space now, if they're just hoping that another few desks of outbound callers will, you know, help them get through the queues that are growing, they're really missing out on a lot of value.
Yeah, I think a lot of organizations would benefit from putting sort of like a customer service marketing, you know, that kind of spin on it. Like, we can help them and we can change the story. Yes, it's at the bottom line, but it's also in their customer journey. So there's the hard dollars, but there's also that soft, squishy, we've got a customer who likes us. We did the right thing.
A customer who talks to us, who likes us, who spends on our product. And in a world where there's more and more competition, you know, once you've got them, you really do want to keep them. And so, Carolyn, if people are listening and now panicking and saying, I need to get some scorecards built, but I don't have the human capital to build them in-house, you can help them there as well, because you're also behind Scores for All.
So I've been working in credit risk, as we pointed out, for a very long time. And I've noticed over the years, there are a couple of consistent trends, whether we're talking application scoring, behavior scoring, collection scoring, doesn't matter what kind of scoring. Some of the large organizations, many of the large organizations, have all the bells, whistles, tools, and resources, and that's awesome. However, there are an extraordinary number of organizations that don't have this. And they also don't have the capital reserves floating around to just go out and buy some of these tools. And it's easier said than done to just quickly build a data science team. So we took all of that and we decided to create Scores for All. You have data and you want a scorecard. Share that data with us. We'll run it through our engines and our proprietary models, and we will return a score to you. As an organization, you get a score without having to worry about the modeling. You don't have to do any of that stuff. You don't have to do the governance of scoring, so you don't need to do all the reporting. We do that and we provide that for you so that you can see how your scores work. We also train models over time so that we've always got the most recent data going into those models, delivering the best models for you. And when it comes to things like behavior or collection scoring, most importantly, we have what we call the scoring engine. So a number of variables aren't just how delinquent are you this month. They are a function of your payments and your balances and how you've paid over a number of months. And we calculate those variables based on the raw data that you send us, which means that from a model implementation point of view, it's infinitely more straightforward because you just have to ingest the score. And if you have a legacy system and you can't put a score into your actual system because so many of us run on legacy systems, that's okay. You can still work with those scores within your collections environment, provided, obviously, you bring your collections team on the journey with you and they understand what these scores are telling them. What will it mean to you and your organization and your subsequent financials if you can have those care conversations, customer service-oriented conversations, much earlier? And that's what we aim to do with Scores for All. So we provide the score, and then you can use that in your strategies to better have the right conversations with the right people at the right time.
Yeah, training, consulting, straight up scorecard building in this case, but you're also doing some writing. You're sharing your knowledge in just about every way possible. I got my copy of It's a Risky Business, a field guide to retail consumer credit in the UK from Amazon. So it's available widely. What does that book cover?
So Amazon is probably a really good bet because it's on all the different Amazon flavors. It isn't in hard copy in bookshops because, funnily enough, it's a really niche audience. What does it cover? It covers pretty much everything that you need to understand from you're not a retail consumer credit risk analyst and you want to be a good one. So we start, and I'm going to grab my book here. We start with basic analytics. So how do we import data? What does that mean? We talk about exploratory data analysis, which if you've done any data science courses is EDA, visualization, really popular, and data validations. And these things are often seen as quite dull and quite boring. Massively important. If you want to be a good analyst, I hate to break it to you, you have to do that stuff and you have to do it well. And then I get into the fundamentals of retail consumer credit risk. So what do we consider a policy rule? So a policy rule would be we will not lend to people under the age of 18 because they legally cannot sign a contract. Whereas a business rule is something that maybe you would override. So we won't lend to people under the age of 25, more of a business rule. So the policy rule is less than 18. Under 25, we might not want to, you know, allow a 22-year-old to buy a Ferrari on credit. We talk about using scorecards, implementing scores. We talk about concepts that are really critical, like tilting by risk. So you accelerate actions or conversations. So in originations world, you may confirm more details for high-risk customers. Some of the other things we look at is what are observation windows and what are performance windows, which is used a lot in scorecard modeling, but it's also used in analytics. I talk about breaking scorecards. I remember being interviewed for a role and I said, yes. And one of the things we do is we break a scorecard, and the CEO got really upset with me because I'm not sure what he thought I meant. But in credit risk, what we actually want to do is we do want to push those limits. Where people are seen as low risk, we want to take fewer actions because they save us, which means that that resource can then be applied to higher risk customers. So what you end up seeing is slightly worse behavior in your good risk customers, better behavior in your higher risk customers, which means that your scorecard doesn't differentiate as well as it did when it started. And that's what I mean by breaking scorecards. Things like transition matrices, we go into Markov chains and how to predict gross charge-off. So I really try and give a good flavor of working through credit risk and credit risk analytics, not scorecard building. I didn't go into scorecard building at all. But I wanted to say, as an analyst, if you want to add value from a credit risk point of view, these are the kinds of things you want to look at. This is why it's important. This is how you do it. This is what it is. And what can you share with your team, your organization, and what impact can you have?
Yeah, and I think that subtitle of a field guide is really informative there because it's written for the practical user. It's not an academic textbook that looks at all the theories and goes deep into topics, you know, that you maybe would study at university. This is for somebody who's working in the field who wants to do their job better. So yeah, a real field guide you want to have in your hand. And so yeah, everyone can head over to Amazon to look for that. Carolyn, you also, well, you've got your training and your speaking. You do other writing as well. So if people listening would like to learn more about that side of your work, keep in touch with you, follow any projects you're rolling out, where can they go online to find you and to learn about some of those businesses?
So probably one of the places you can find out about me is LinkedIn. I'm definitely there. As we mentioned, I've got my website, carolynrom.com. I'm a little bit on Substack. I tend to talk about my summer of swimming. So it's not really work-related, but if you're interested in long-distance swimming, sometimes I write about that. Yeah, those are most of the places you can find me, a little bit on Medium.
Yeah, long-distance swimming and underwater hockey, I saw.
Yes, my two passions.
A sport we've not featured on the show before, I have to say. But yeah, Carolyn, I think you've covered some really great topics for this audience in particular. We do talk from time to time with people that get deep into things like machine learning and AI and those tools. And, you know, we talk to scorecard builders and how they build scores. And all of those are incredibly valuable for organizations, but they've got to be put together as well. And I think that to have these sort of services to grow your teams, to grow yourself, is important. To understand how to grow to take on the next role is important. To have that book at your side is important. So really, for people listening, yeah, you said it's not a big niche, but for us in the credit risk space, many ways that you can help. So I certainly recommend everyone go look for you on LinkedIn or carolynrom.com. It's worth it if you've got a team to think about what you're doing for your staff to build those sort of capabilities in them as well, which I'll remind everyone is available anywhere in the world online. So thank you so much for making the time to join me today. It's been a treat.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been lovely.
And thank you all for listening. Please do look for and follow the show on your favorite podcast platform and share the updates widely on LinkedIn. Plus, send me a connection request while you're there. This show is written and recorded by myself, Brendan LaGrange, in Brighton, England. Show music is by I Am Wake, and you can find show notes and written transcripts at www.howtolendmoneytostrangers.show. And I'll see you again next Thursday.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.